Thanks for joining me today, Sumitra. Really excited to have you here.
Yo, Rashad. It is good to see you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start our journey back in 2005. Talk to me about your high school days and how you decided to pursue neuroscience.
2005, I was 15. I only did nerd extracurriculars and incredibly bad JV tennis. I think I lost every single game that I ever played in 3 years. Incredibly bad tennis, with an incredibly patient coach. Speech and debate, science research, mock trial, were my, and science Olympiad were my really big extracurriculars. Speech and debate really being my passion. I equivocated a lot on what I wanted my major to be when I went to college. I actually originally declared classics, and I was very keen to be a classics major. The small liberal arts school where I went to made a bet that no one who wanted to be pre-med would also want to be classics. So all the classics language classes conflicted with science labs, so I could never actually be a classics major. So neuroscience was very much a philosophical thing. I always found the fact that we're conscious and it feels like something to be alive to be the most strange and mysterious like thing in the universe. And it made me really curious about neuroscience as a field because it felt like the most important kind of question to ask. And neuroscience is such a interdisciplinary science. It's like very much an applied science. And I love the fact that I got to dabble in the concepts I was learning in chemistry, in physics, in simple biology, in computer science and math, all of those in psychology and cognitive psychology in particular. Like it was a field that had so many different kinds of lenses from different fields. So for all those reasons, when I did go to college, I found all of that very appealing.
There's a general theory in investing that the people who succeed as founders kind of fit this persona where they had atypical hobbies in high school and in undergrad, possibly. Do you find that rings through when you diligence founders and tell our audience how you spend your days now? Do you go deep into their careers and into their history and hobbies when they were children as well?
You know, it's a good question. I'll start by where I spend my time. I work part-time as a physician, as an internal medicine hospitalist at a historic hospital in San Francisco in the community, treating a mostly poor local population that I'm very, very fond of. I run my VC fund full-time, Med Mountain Ventures, pre-seed, seed. With Brandon, another physician, we helped build the fund several years ago. And that was a whole story that we may get into later. And in my spare time, between my two jobs, my wife and I have recently become obsessed with surfing, which is my new version of tennis, something that I love doing and I'm just absolutely terrible at. I differ from a lot of investors. A lot of investors are very dogmatic about types and vibes. I'm very much a, see people for all their complexity. There's many different ways of being right. It really matters, is your strategy coherent? Is it coherent with my goals? I'm also a really big believer that we've had a generation of gut check intuitions that are sometimes right, often wrong. And there's a lot of money left on the table when you over-index on those kinds of, gut checks and vibes. So for me, the psychological profile of founder, atypical hobby thing, if it's true, I would find it, interesting and speaking to a certain pattern of facts. But if it's wrong, I wouldn't see it as, a bad thing by any means. Some of my best founders came from resource poor, very strict childhoods overseas, where if they had any atypical hobbies, they would have been met with a slap on the face, not with, praise and validation. And they're incredibly, serious, competent, well-adjusted, living life of mine founders now, but they didn't have that particular story. And that makes sense. Like, given their background, it wouldn't be what I would expect for them. So I see it as my short answer is I don't think of it in that way, but my larger answer is the way I always like to see people not as, just themselves, but like a whole pattern. And I like to keep an open mind about all the different ways and shapes and sizes those patterns could be that could be coherent. Mindful, it may not be the kind that fits the sort of patterns that I had when I grew up.
We'll go back to your undergrad days soon. There's a lot of talk in the big VC firms that AI will replace a lot of jobs, but it's never their job it will replace. It will replace all the other jobs but mine. What do you agree with that statement? And then I'll kind of going back to your work as a hospitalist as well. Do you think AI will replace a hospitalist or a VC's job first?
Great questions. In both, there's a commonality with both. In both, you have someone who exercises judgment and sits with liability. And there's institutional value, if nothing else, in having an individual who sits with liability as opposed to having, kind of like, faceless liability. There's something about, the buck stops with someone is on the hook and they respond. They're on the hook for it. And because of that, the system kind of pays them, mostly for that. I see a lot of clerical things that I do in the hospital as an internal medicine hospitalist, really is like the system being like, we need someone to do this, who sits with liability, who oversees it, because they make even better judgments than, if that person were out of the loop. For structural reasons, I think that there's value in having, some number of people. I see it less as the zero, like the one job going to zero is always very hard. It becomes like, like one of those asymptotes where it just exponentially takes off. I see it as more like you may have 100, but maybe you could get by with 80, maybe you could get by with 60, maybe you could get back with 40. Could you make that one person far more efficient? Instead of zero radiologists, if you have one radiologist doing the work of 1.4 radiologists, that's still a radical subversion of the status quo. And that one is like much more achievable. I could see it that way. On the hospitalist side, there are parts of my job that, with really good automation, I could, greatly scale away. The most time-consuming part of my job is the sitting at the bedside, holding hands and crying part of my job, the meeting people on the worst day of their lives, being there, navigating people, complex situations, being like, this old person with dementia lives alone. They have a daughter who they abandoned when they were two. They have a landlord who like kind of shows up and helps them out. The landlord and the daughter disagree. Who do I make the surrogate decision maker? Like, who do I turn to represent the interests of this person? It's like stuff like that takes up most. I think also I work in a really socially complex population, so this may not be like a representative answer of what doctors do. This may land as strange to many people listening. Like, what is this dude doing? Like, what a. But anyways, it's like these are like the arts of my job, and those are harder things to automate. You could have an advanced AI solution, do it. Even a perfect solution would probably just like not land as, credible in the same way. So on the hospitalist side, maybe one hospitalist can do the work of 1.4 hospitalists in the future. Would it go to zero? I don't think so. There's a certain kind of like top year license, craft, intuition thing that you do. On the VC side, it's interesting. You sent me this message about quantitative trading a few days ago. And I've been thinking a lot about that. I think it depends on what is the kind of transaction you do, how much ambiguity are you assuming, how liquid is the market, what are the stakes of being wrong? If I were a high frequency trader, it would be much easier to replace me with a machine. And it's sort of a silly thing to say because high frequency traders are machines. Like they're essentially people who program machines. Like humans can't do that kind of asset trading anymore. But it's essentially extremely low transaction cost, super high information transactions, where if you're wrong in a microsecond, you liquidate your entire holdings. VC transactions are like super high ambiguity. They often involve doing things that are unprecedented and never seen before. So if you template match off what existed before, you may get mismatches, and it's extremely illiquid. So it's harder to do. But in terms of not going from one to zero, but one person doing the work of 1.5, the amount of time I've spent doing admin, overhead, clerical, et cetera, is exponentially lower today than it was a year ago because we built a whole bunch of internal AI-based workflows. Sorry, Rashad, you asked for tight answers, and here I am giving long essays. Please forgive me.
Let's stick with this. Something I've been thinking about is what patterns can I recognize with founders? And I've been debating with putting, and maybe putting founders through is not the right terminology because I would be asking them and they can say no. Psychological tests and some validated, some not, like Myers-Briggs and Enneagrams and other forms of psychological testing. And seeing if I can find patterns on what archetype makes the best founder. Now, I know this goes against vibe investing, or, I like this founder, they can sell. I don't know why they can sell. I don't know why I like them. They're just a charming person. Do you think there is an avenue, and are you doing this, trying to break down what founder charm means? And really trying to analyze that and trying to figure out quantitative patterns that then you can use to say, all the founders who apply to my fund do this test, and then you have a filter before you speak to the founder.
I am, in terms of psychometrics, one of the things I really appreciate about neuroscience and also all the psychology classes I took was doing a really deep dive on, the academic rigor, the face, and other kinds of validity for different kinds of psychometric tests. I would argue that most of our psychometric tests, the very best psychometric tests we have, are not great. There's no universal test. They tend to be very culturally specific. They tend not to generalize well over time. The rigor of evidence behind them tends to be poor. A lot of them come from a particularly bad era of like psychology research that was kind of bogus and bunk. So I see them as very flawed tools. It's okay to use flawed tools. We do this in science all the time where we're like, our measure is flawed. We know how it's flawed, so we can still use it in an effective way. If it's a final thought or a final part of a conversation, I would warn against that kind of workflow. I think that you would leave a lot of money on the table, filter out a lot of people. If it's like the start of a conversation and it surfaces things, I think in that way it would be useful. And I'll toss out something strange, and this is going to sound very flippant, but I really love tarot. I have this little tarot app on my, like tarot cards, those like, like I really enjoyed it. My wife and I were bored sometime in the pandemic, so we like, got really into this deep dive of tarot. And tarot I like because, objectively, and I say this in candor, this may offend people, although I doubt the people who'd listen to your podcast. Tarot is bogus, but it's sort of fun because you flip something and you're like, this is death upside down. And it corresponds to this very kind of like vague and strange thing. But then I'm like, I never really thought about vague and strange things. It applies to like this decision, but it's just like a radically different point of view and a very strange one for me to revisit this thing that I'm thinking through. And sometimes, just randomly flipping tarot and taking a really weird point of view and being like, oh, like, I didn't think of this decision with these considerations, but just getting out of my head and getting into a radically different framework, it's surface stuff. I see that as an example of it's okay to use flawed tools if you see the flaws and you use it as starting a conversation. Like, MBTI is great if you get like an ENTJ or something and you're like, this person, perhaps they're gruff, perhaps they're confident, maybe they're overconfident. I'm curious to see, what do they think about this? What do I learn about? I do some amount of, psychological pinging when I diligence, but for me, it's much more like, how do you and I disagree? How do you and I have conflict? If I have a point of view and you have a point of view, do I have influence with you? Are you like, when you have a thought process, like, how do you communicate? Like, how are you in conflict? Like, how are you with pushback? How do you treat people on your team? What are your internal dynamics? Those are like some of the like psychological factors that I probe, but I see it as very much there's no necessarily best pattern. Really, it's like, is your pattern effective for the sort of larger strategy that you're taking?
Neuroscience, I think, is a very academic field, and you can break down our brain. And I think the science on this has changed recently into different pathways and cortical tracts. And this is what this does. This part of the brain is responsible for this. Political science, I would say, is on the opposite spectrum, where it's more about people and how you interact with people. How can you grow a movement? I'm sure that the science part of political science is challenged at times. How did you go from neuroscience to political science? Or is it more streamlined than I'm making it out to be?
When I was in college, I did a lot of student organizing, student union stuff. It was also the financial crisis, so a lot of stuff was going on. I'd see it less as it was something that I did and more just that the world happened to us. 2008 happened, budget cutbacks happened. I was at a college with a very progressive approach to financial aid, and there was this tension between faculty who said, don't, stop hiring like the best faculty and paying them well. Maybe consider not being so like extremely generous with your financial aid as like another area to cut. So we had a lot of moral gazing about, what is the mission of this institution? What is important? How do we treat like, the vulnerable? How do we see these things? It was one of those things where, just like it wasn't that I sought it out, but the world happened. And I'm very sympathetic to free societies. It was like 2011, 2012. Stuff was going on in Russia. Like young people were going on the streets and protesting. Stuff was going on in Myanmar. Arab Spring was starting to kindle. There was one round of Iran protests. There was a lot of interesting things happening globally. People who look like me and you at that time were going and, being willing to be gunned down or have acid thrown in their face or all kinds of horrible stuff. So I got really into, I spent this period of my life thinking, how do I build organizations and influence and kind of find like key people and elites and like, get them resources and back them. I saw that as a lot of stuff that just sort of happened and I fell into it. I didn't go towards it. But when I was in there, it really introduced me to these frameworks of, and I think this is what you're talking about when you say political science, political risk and political economy. Political risk is thinking for any kind of industry, any kind of business, any kind of anything, how does the political situation matter? And political economy is any country or any sector where it doesn't matter necessarily like how good markets are, et cetera. It's like the role of government is just so incredibly powerful. So if you're in like a very corrupt country, it's all political economy. It doesn't matter how good your idea is. It's like, but how do you get it through your local ministry that you have to, deal with? And like, how do you like, navigate that in healthcare? It's all political economy. Like all costs are driven by political economy. All revenues are driven by political economy. And it's very much understanding, how do you see the balance of power between different stakeholders? How does it change over time? How do you see like the government's point of view on antitrust creating like windows and weaknesses? A lot of the political stuff that I did unintentionally just because the world swept me up in it way back when, it gave me this sensibility that I found very helpful as a healthcare investor.
Early on, and I'm not that, I've only been investing for almost 3 years now. When I started, I would have these future maps in my head. I would say this is where the healthcare world is going, and this is what the market needs. I'm going to define this product I'm looking for, and epigenetics was one of them, and home care, hospital home care was another one. And then I'm going to go out and find the best founders working in these specific niches. Currently, what I'm looking for is a founder working on an end-to-end solution for inbox management. And I still find myself predefining the market, which I'm looking for. There's another train of thought, and this is a more popular one, is as long as the founder is building something in health, I will back the best founder I can find. I will deviate from my thesis, of markets I'm looking for, and I would just go for the best founders. Do you have these mind maps where you're looking for these opportunities? These are the opportunities, and I just want to find the best person who's building in this? Or are you just generally, as long as it has the word health in it, I just want the best founder building in healthcare as a whole?
I think that's a very good question. I would say our approach is very much the second, because when we raise these funds, we have these predefined investment periods. So I have like 3 years, 5 years. So I have to get most of my first checks out during this pre-specified time. So there's this thing of what is the best, the most interesting that I'm seeing right now. But with that said, how we rank what the best healthcare idea is, if we do the second strategy, it really requires doing the first strategy. Like, if you were to go out and say, who has the most credible healthcare ideas right now? It's often not like in our sector, it's like I think the real winner, I've been thinking a lot about this, like the real winners in our sector long term, they don't win just based on like, I'm making money or like money is going up month over month. they're doing something like weird and strategic and like subversive in a very like long-term visionary way. So if you were to go out and be like, what is the best healthcare company being built right now, doing the second approach, you'd still probably be executing the first approach where you're like, hospital at home is where the puck is going. I have conviction on that. Like enabling technologies today, like those will be the best value companies today. They're going to be worth a ton of money in the imminent future. Like that's like the best, most rational place for me to invest. How does that land on you, Rashad?
Yeah, I think I have under-indexed for how much the founder matters. And this may sound funny because you hear all the time the founder is the most important thing. But given my somewhat rebellious thought nature, I inherently want to think against what everyone else is saying. And sometimes I think what everyone else is saying is right. You know, being consensus correct is easy to do. Going against the consensus being correct is very difficult, and usually you're wrong. So I'm changing my mind there, and this is kind of just born out of experience. I've invested in startups, and I'm not going to name names, with amazing products. You know, this product is at that point at least I would say 5 times better than anything else out there. But the founder conviction, and specifically founder charm, and this I don't like that this is the truth. That founder charm matters so much. Because I like to think substance and the product should matter more than salesmanship. But I'm starting to realize, and or I have realized, salesmanship matters a lot more. You know, I've changed my thinking on this. And I am more indexing for the ability to sell, and just finding the best founder. Right. If I have these predefined market maps and I can't find the best founder or no amazing founders building in them, then that's okay. I will just go for the best founder. And they will teach me about the market and where the world is going. And that's a little bit of ego, because I like to believe, because I'm a physician, because I'm thinking about this a lot, I can see where the world is going. But I think being a people picker and not a market picker is probably the better way to do this.
You know, it's a good question. I was at dinner with a couple of the physician VCs in San Francisco, and one of them, who I believe is a mutual friend, we were just talking about like, you know, what we do. And I said, we tend to be super hands-on. We love finding founders where we're like, this founder can grow to be a world-class executive. We can help get them there. And because we help build them, we invested a great valuation now. We're specialists, is what we do. We pick up the phone, we help, we coach, we mentor. It's what gives me joy. And I will make this person a total baller. It's going to be great. Like, that's a good formula. And this person is like, I only choose founders who I never have to help again. I am a zero value add investor by design. Our founders have to be so good, they never need help for anything. And it was just such a fun and bombastic and wild point of view that, definitely had an impact on me. For what it's worth, I see it as, you know, our sector, it's not enough just to build the best product in our sector. Our sector is so busted and super corrupt and crazy that you have to be, it really helps to have good, if deeply favors insiders, it helps to have some kind of insider ability to navigate. Or at least if you're a total outsider, have a certain kind of super sophistication to be able to navigate and execute in our field. Like too many super smart people, totally outsiders, actually build the thing that's very important, but it's not in dialogue with the healthcare system as it is, and it can't be influential if it's not. So I see a lot of value in, like when I look for a really good founder, I want to make sure that they can be effective in the world as it is. I see it as if they have deficiencies, I think of it as, are these things that I can help with? Can I round it out with a key hire? Can I round it out with mentorship? Is it the kind of thing where I have influence, I don't have influence? But that's also part of an investment strategy where I actually like to be really hands-on. I like to be like, you know, super domainy. Like, you know, it's part of how I source. It's part of how I get into the best deals of the deals that I get into. It's part of how I build my relationship and my brand. It's part of the promise I make LPs. So I would say it's a very reasonable strategy. It's coherent for me. And our colleague, the one who's like, I never help people, you know, like they can get bent after I give them a check, just go make money. You know, his strategy works for him because that's like totally the way he does. He's like only moonshots. It's either, 100x or 0x. He doesn't want 5x, and he just wants to spray and pray. And that's also a totally valid coherent strategy. I think where it goes wrong is if you mix and match. Like if you spray and pray, but then you spend too much time trying to be value add with a financial strategy that doesn't support you in being value add, it doesn't work. Or in turn, if I do a lot of like prospective bets where like this person could pop, and I have a lot of concentrated risk that they can pop, and then I do nothing to help them pop, it's like a bad execution of my strategy. So I'd say the behavior could be a good behavior or a bad behavior. It really depends on how does it fit into a whole scheme.
If a company like OpenEvidence came to you and offered you something in their next round, would you invest in them? So a company that's growing, that has the potential to grow quite a bit more, but in the general thesis of things, it's a little bit too big. They're already valued at over $1 billion. Would you invest in them?
If it was a company with excellent fundamentals, a valuation that I could believe, and it was, a deal that I would love, and it was totally out of scope for the fund, what I would do is not invest out of the fund, but I'd go to my LPs and say, listen, it's out of scope of the fund. I'm not doing you dirty by not investing your fund money in this because, I made a promise for how I would spend that. This is out of scope. But this deal is on the table. I'll go to insiders first. If you're interested, we can get you access. We can create the vehicle to do it. I would first go to all my, I'd first make sure it's out of scope. If it's totally out of scope, I'd go to my current fund LPs. Then I go to all my firm LPs. And then I would go to just friends and others in the ecosystem in that order. I feel like that's the honest, fiduciary thing to do if a really good deal comes by. How do you think about it? What is your take?
Yeah, to be frank with you, I've been struggling with this question because I'm sort of dealing with it right now, and I like your answer because I don't think it's fair to my investors to not present that opportunity and not invest in it myself, given that I believe that there is room for considerable more growth, and it's a great company to invest in and a great mission to back. Yeah, so I'm kind of on board here where. I think it's fair. Now, given the question then becomes with your investors come back to you said, I already invested in the fund. Can you invest in this company out of the fund? Because my fiduciary duty is to the investors, that's something I think I would be open to. How would you deal with that request from your LPs?
We're going through fund creation right now, so we spent a lot of time doing some philosophical reflection. I would see it this way. I would see it as, is it discretionary? Is there a wiggle room or not? If there's wiggle room based on the fund mandate, what we promised, et cetera, if there's wiggle room, then I would consider taking it to an LPAC, like an LP advisory committee. And I would say, this deal, it's sort of bending our scope, but it's not crazy out of scope. What do you think? What do you think? It's a good opportunity. The LPs want it. What do you think? And I would use the LPAC as a way for LPs to have influence to make the decision. If it's widely out of scope, it sounds tough, but I would tell them, people made a bet on us and they expect their money. I think of it as Gaussians. Like a portfolio is really a bunch of Gaussians that behave in different ways and correlate to different things. And what we did is we promised to be one certain kind of Gaussian for people's portfolios. And we owe it to them to behave as we promised them. Like that's what gives them predictability. That's what gives them success. I could easily get into trading corn futures. And honestly, depending on what's going on with tariffs and stuff, corn futures are probably a really good idea right now. I could totally get into like trading corn futures and I could totally like, make some good money. I saw this like crypto bankruptcy debt transaction come across my desk that was extremely attractive and had absolutely zero relevance. And people made some kind of crazy 5x, 6x return very quickly doing this bankruptcy transaction on this notable recent crypto company that went down. And it was a really cool deal. And it was just so widely out of scope. It would be like wrong for me and the Gaussian behavior I promised my LPs if I did make money, but I did it in a way that was like, a risk profile and a bet that's like way wild from what I promised. So that's how I'd see it. If it was plausible, take it to LPAC. If it's not plausible, it sounds tough to say, but I'd say, you know, it's not right. It's not right. We're not being a good fiduciary to all of our LPs if we do this, even if some LPs want. What I would tell them is, you know, how can we make this right? If you want SPV allocation, and if it's an all insider SPV, like we'll do it without fees or whatever, like we're here for you. I can't do it out of the fund. It's not right. But I can, like, you know, help you otherwise.
Going back to your undergrad days, was med school always on the card?
I did my best to get out of it, and I had a lot of South Asian pressure to go into it. I would describe it as schizophrenic. I fell in love with medicine, but I was pretty far on my journey before I did. I think that I went into it definitely with the wrong motives and definitely with bad decision making. Whenever I give advice to people, I'm always like, you know, I'll tell you what I did. And I'm like, don't do what I did. Like, I'll give you frameworks and I'll tell you the frameworks I wish I used. But, you know, I made it work and it is so dumb lucky that I did. I kind of love medicine. And in hindsight, you know, I'm glad I did what I did. But by all means, you know, it's kind of dumb luck that I fell in love with it.
And how did you decide to do an MBA while in med school?
I had this startup, the political stuff that was going on in the world just really swept me up into it. And I was doing a bunch of stuff with this colleague of mine. He was all in. A lot of stuff was coming to a head. And we just needed some time to see if we could make it work and where we could take it. And there was no way to get time off other than doing it via a degree. So I shot my shot and I got really lucky. And my very weird application, which was largely panned by very normal people, was very well received by Stanford, for which I'm very grateful. So then I went and I did my MBA at Stanford. And I spent my first year basically treating it as a face-saving excuse so I could work all my spare time on this other thing that I had going on.
And tell me a bit more about the other thing you had going on.
We got really good at building political movements, both around famous people and organizing large amounts of young people in the US and around the world, and very, very good at trafficking in elites, trafficking in for young people, student body presidents of top universities, Rhodes Scholars, Olympians, kids of billionaires, like, you know, the kids and Nobel laureates. On the flip side, it would be like the Nobel laureates, a whole bunch of US ambassadors, a bunch of foreign intelligence heads, a couple heads of state. We got like really into if anyone was doing something around any of the causes we cared about. We cared a lot about countering violent extremism. We cared a lot about free society movements overseas, getting people access to elite resources, doing things like, you know, taking someone who's like an intelligence chief from like, you know, one of the allied, you know, European powers who's now focusing on countering violent extremism. This one, you know, ISIS was recruiting on Facebook, that era, taking them around Silicon Valley, taking them to all the tech companies and like, you know, sitting them down and doing these like high level conversations around, you know, how do we do this? Track two diplomacy was also really interesting at this time. There was a lot of Middle Eastern tension, especially around Iran. And it'd be kind of cool that we could do stuff like get a former head of Mossad and a former chief nuclear negotiator of Iran, who, depending on how a presidential election goes, is either extremely influential or hiding out in Princeton and getting them, you know, talking and arguing on the side and getting like a small stuff like that. We were just really good at doing that kind of stuff. It had, and every now and then we'd be really good at monetizing it, but we kept finding cool opportunities to have impact that never really lent to monetization. We built a lot of network power and we never really found a way to make a lot of cash. It was work that we were really good at doing, and it was work that I enjoyed until I didn't. It was very much white knuckle politics, and you had to have a very high tolerance for constant conflict. It was a lot of take a favor, call a favor, burn people. Like, you know, there'd be so many people mad at you. Some of them would be kind of scary people overseas who were, you know, quasi mobsters. You'd just sort of, you know, you'd end up in a lot of situations where you're like, you know, this is a lot. The person I did it with was both extremely talented at it and had a supernatural patience for conflict. But at some point, I was just like so spiritually crushed and unhappy. I didn't like the way that I was treating people, and it just wasn't work that I wanted to do. So that was my sort of like full arc of that journey, which played out during my 1.5 years of my 2 years of my MBA.
What are some tactics you use to get these people in the same room together? Because I'm assuming a lot of people would love to, there's a kind of the common saying, your network is your net worth. How were you able to get all these very influential people who run big structures and countries in the world, come in the same room together? As determined by a couple MBA 20 somethings at Stanford.
Good question. A lot of it was what I would call silo arbitrage. Inside a silo, there's a very clear ladder for influence. Across silos, it's very unclear. And if you take two very different silos and you cross-pollinate them, it's very hard for, it's like usually the connections don't exist. People are usually very flattered to be asked, and it's very hard for them to size up, like, is this like someone at my ladder level, above me, below me? And essentially what we did is we just sort of like, parlayed. We'd be like, we have access. Here's like someone who we had a, my colleague had a mentor who was a very important civil rights era leader at the State Department and a very prominent ambassador to some very key countries. But these are not like the first 25 countries that you would name, but they were very important in the year 1980. And for people in the State Department, this guy was a legend. And it's like, his mentorship and sponsorship built us a lot of goodwill with a lot of recent ambassadors to a lot of countries. And when you have those people who are like, the presidential election change, like with the change of like party in the like presidency, a lot of political appointees are out. They're now back just like in the wild. They tend to be very powerful and influential people. So you go to them, they're flattered to be asked because you have the other guy. They have incredible cachet with like the elites in the countries where they used to be the US ambassador to. Then you get to know them. And then like you take those elites and then you're like, in turn, you sort of like do a parlay where you're like, this is really siloed, this is really siloed, that's really siloed. I have connections here, and it's kind of intriguing in their swagger. And how do I do something that's like very valuable and useful and use this to meet people in that silo? And in turn, when I meet people in that silo, like, what can I do that's very valuable? I think a lot of it is knowing what is valuable to people? Who do people not know? And a lot of it is like, what is the kind of information that's like intriguing and valuable? Like, it's much better now, but at that time, the Bay Area was relatively disconnected from DC politics and the foreign affairs apparatus. You could get a lot of interesting conversations and bring some really visionary people to the table by bringing interesting foreign affairs types, policy types out this way. It was just like a pathway that was not very well worn. So by doing that, we would just get interesting people at the table and then we'd get to know them. And the student network asset that we had was also super useful. There was like a whole bunch of people who were like, listen, I'm launching a book and I'd love to get like 500 people to turn out for this event. And we could, swap favors with various people and like, get those kinds of crowds. So things like that. A lot of it was, parlaying, like doing something and thinking like 3 steps ahead and being like, how do we parlay this into that? And like, what's valuable for everyone? Like, how do we solve their problems in a way that, furthers our work?
I believe that cultural heterogeneity is the path to quote unquote world peace. I think intermingling cultures, races, and following the Singapore experiment where we're dividing residential areas to ensure that the amount of diversity is stable across residential areas. You don't get a little Portugal and a little Italy. It's all intermixed. I think that is the only path, I believe, for us to live peacefully in this world. Given what you know about politics and people, if you could snap your fingers and get rid of the concept of nations and have the world be one country, would you do it? And if you would, why? And if not, why not?
It's a good question. I think your point is a good one that people mixing is a good thing. If I could get rid of countries today, I would not. if I could make movement between countries much easier, I would. I think that the world, I would make two observations. The first is that the world has many different countries, all of which have different configurations of social networks, freedoms, rights, obligations, etc. And if people could freely move and find the place where they agree philosophically with where they are, that kind of flow of people, I think, is a directionally good thing. Like, as a secular trend, that kind of movement is good. There's a lot of ambiguity about what the right way is to dial a lot of these levers. You could say that the US has a very coherent bet around innovation versus a relatively brittle safety net. Canada is on that spectrum, but it's a little bit closer to like a slightly more robust safety net, but not more so. Sweden is on that spectrum, but it's like, more so like, on the safety net side, but innovative enough, certainly not innovative. And all of those are reasonable bets. Like a very reasonable person a priori would be very happy for doing the whole, veil of ignorance thing. Someone could be very happy through the veil, choosing to be in any one of those societies based on totally normal preferences. Fully respect that. Totally respect that. There was this really good book. I never actually learned how to say his last name. I'm going to put it in chat in case you know how to say it. Have you ever heard of this guy? He's a MIT economic historian, Turkish.
I have his book, but I haven't read it.
His book is awesome. His book is awesome. Darren Akimoglu. His books are, he wrote a really good book on technology, power, and social transformation. All of these things that were great technologies on a secular trend, like a super long 50, 100-year trend. Such as, automation in the textile industry in the United Kingdom or, England way back when. All of those were good trends that lurched society forward. And they were just like super catastrophic, wrecked a bunch of lives. People went hungry, people died. Like it was super frictional when it actually went down. Really good secular trends tend to be very frictional. And it's useful to, I feel like the past 15 years has been like a very humbling demonstration of, just what those are. I feel like if nation borders disappeared today, you'd have 7 billion people with wildly different configurations of how they want to live, what obligations they feel towards each other, et cetera. Over 1,000 years, it may be a very stable equilibrium that emerges, but the chaos of that would be quite high. But if we kept borders today and we had better and freer movement of people and goods across borders, that would be still pretty revolutionary, but I think a much more gentle change.
For those listening, his book, and I have read a third of it, Power and Progress, Our 1,000-Year Struggle Over Technology and Prosperity. And it's Darren and Simon Johnson. And I think it picks on this notion that, and this is again a common notion among the investing world, that, all technologies improve humanity and are net positive. And from what I remember, Darren argues that that's not necessarily true. When do you think we will cross the barrier of too much technology, too much efficiency, and we will actually suffer? Maybe we will live 200 years, but it will be 200 years filled with depression and sadness and misery as opposed to living a happy 70 years.
I'm a big fan of growth. I'm a big fan of growth, and I'm a big fan of the potential for a great future. Human norms have to change around the state of technology, and human norms are very slow to change. You see this with birth rates, where a lot of countries, when child mortality drops, birth rates continue to be very high, and you see, a lot of frictions in population. You'd see that as an example of how human norms are slow. You see teachers talk about Gen Alpha and how spooked they are about the weird behaviors. I don't know how old your kids are, Rashad, if they're Gen Alpha or Gen Z, but you see teachers, I'm sure you had a lot of philosophical conversations with your wife about screen time. It's a good example of how it takes a hot minute for people to norm around technology. I think technology is great in the long term, and I see it not as we should see technology as good or see technology as bad. But we should see it as where there's friction, there's light. And where there's friction, there's just so much heat. And the heat's a reality. The heat can be really destabilizing. I think a lot of the political trends we've seen in the past 5, 6 years in Europe are an example of very well-intended, visionary policies around things like refugees, an issue very like close to me and important to me, and then like a wild societal backlash, against too many refugees too quickly, leading to like wild swings in politics and a lot of destabilization in global politics. And you see that and you're like, sometimes it's worth kind of slow walking and being a little bit more cautious. If we're really thinking about what stages is best on the order of like 200 years and 500 years, sometimes going slower, but I would say it's definitely not worth stopping. It's more, we should see it as trade-offs, we should see it as complex.
The startup founding team A has an amazing AI engineer, but a mediocre domain expert. And for building in healthcare, a mediocre physician or a clinician. Startup founding team B has a mediocre engineer, but an amazing physician or clinician on the team. Which team do you pick?
Totally depends. All my answers,
Good.
every time we do this, Rashad, I always give my it totally depends and my it's not categorical. It's all hyper contextual. So I must be your most tedious guest. I would argue this. At every company, at every phase, there is an axis of complexity. There's like a single thing that just stands above as the hardest possible thing that they do. For example, sometimes it is technology. Like the really hard thing about this company is this very, very hard tech problem. Sometimes, especially in our sector, because our sector is so busted, corrupt, and inefficient, it's entirely strategic. The technology exists off the shelf. The exact configuration of how you use it, how you dial it in, requires an exceptional strategic savvy well beyond what a common person off the street can do. Like that itself is distinguishing enough to be the thing that's the basis of the company. Some companies are like hardcore deep tech companies. You got to have the smartest people in the world doing it, and it totally pays. And in that case, it's like do the engineer team, and either I play the role of the clinician, or we replace the clinician, or we upskill the clinician, or we do whatever. But the engineer is like a scarce asset, and it makes sense. If that like weak physician, strong engineer is doing something else. So, for example, one of my very successful companies is doing an MSO strategy with pediatric OTs. And it's very similar to what's been done in mental health. And it is a technologically straightforward, almost trivial company, largely doing technologically solved problems, but it has an extremely strategic, very domain specific kind of go to market. If you have the very weak clinician, strong engineer doing the latter business, they're totally going to flounder because, like, the really good engineer is using like 1% of their strength. It's like if you and I were lifting weights and you could lift, like, if you bench like, 350 pounds and I bench, I forget, my real bench is like, I don't know, like 50, it's like the bar plus a little bit. But you and I are benching 1 pound dumbbells. Like, it doesn't matter that you can bench, like, like my hand will move like pretty fast as well. Like, I'm barely using your raw power. So it's like, how much does the raw power matter in that case? So I see it as that. I see it as like, what is the kind of problem they're solving? Another company that I'm very fond of did AI hearing aids, and they solved a bunch of very complex human audiology, audiogram problems. And it was essentially a like math company, like a math physiology company for like, 6 years. And there it paid to have the most hardcore domain experts ever. And now they're commercializing in hearing aids, which is like a super strategic busted space. And the complexity is entirely generic strategy go to market complexity. It's not like, best engineer in the world complexity.
Do you think a good distribution strategy or a good network into your customers could be where defensibility lies? Oftentimes, when I look for
Totally.
defensibility, as you know, what's IP? But it could just be like I'm an influencer in this space, and that's my defensibility.
I would say more than influencer, if you can get sales and grab land. Have you used a bridge, Rashad? Like, have you used a bridge when rounding? I saw the inpatient workflow for my hospital and it was garbage. It was like totally garbage. It was so bad. And for this to be the unicorn incumbent best company in the field, and I'm like, this product is trash. For my use case specifically, like the amount of redundancy and work that it takes, like opening up a portal, copying, pasting text, like, it is so silly and bad at what it does, at least for Android and for inpatient hospitalist rounding. It just sucks. It's totally built for a very different use case. And my employer is very much like, it doesn't matter. This is what we're doing. This is what Epic likes. This is what, our hospital system likes. This is what's going, like, it's entirely a distribution thing. The best product doesn't win. The meritocracy doesn't work in healthcare. It is like way too corrupt. Access to distribution, strategically navigating tech lockout, tech value chain is where a lot of value comes up. There's also why whenever you hang out with doctors, all we ever do is complain about the tools we have, because it's like weird things lead to the winners. It's not like the best product won, and next week when a better product comes out, we'll immediately grab it. It's entirely who grabbed land and had these relationships to navigate way back when.
That being said, how much do you index for having an amazing product when looking at founders? And I'll kind of frame this conversation is that I've had conversations with founders where I'm looking at their product, I'm looking at what they're saying, and I'm thinking, there's no way this is going to succeed. And then they say, we launched 6 months ago and we're doing 200,000 a month in revenue. How do you kind of deal with that scenario, and what do you do when that happens?
I love being wrong because there's something that I thought was true that's not true. So I'd be very intrigued in that situation to be like, why was my gut hunch way wrong? I put a lot of value in empiric validation. When I think of products, I think of them in the context of enterprise sales. In healthcare, no one can say yes, but everyone can say no. It's like the worst kind of and hardest enterprise sale. And I think of it specifically. I use a sales qualification system called MedPick. I like to go through it letter by letter. There's a really good Salesforce article that breaks it down and is like, here are all the categories. Here's how you kind of qualify, your pipeline to say this is a good customer, this is a bad customer. I go through that framework and I try to understand if I was looking at a sales pipeline, is this a product that could get through an enterprise sales process? I would think about, is this something an economic buyer, an internal champion, and an end user would all be thrilled about? And I see it as, there's this joke that I hear from a lot of my friends who are in their 30s who are single and dating, where, anything less than a hell yeah is a hell no, where you just have to, like, it's like you're kind of like in your groove and you're very settled. If you're going to change something, you really have to be ripped out of your seat. The same is true for enterprise sales. You got to be ripped out of your seat. It's got to be really good. It's got to be motivating to all those key holders. So if they don't have sales, I think a lot theoretically about that framework. And I think about how does it, when I picture a year from now and they're actually selling, like where will this product naturally be successful? Where will it get stuck? What are the kinds of customers? Where in those customers will it get stuck? Like, and how do I form an opinion about, like, can any product win in this space and get through? And like, are they, what do the founders think? Are they sophisticated in sales? Do they have discipline? Like, if I offer this framework, how do they engage? If it was the example you gave where they're like, yeah, like mic drop, we're doing 200K in sales, we just launched, I'd be like, that's pretty dope. And I'd be like, what worked? What worked? And how do I use my, like, framework of how enterprise sales happen to figure out, my theory of mind for all those stakeholders and different kinds of customers? Clearly, these folks discovered something interesting. And I'd be like, teach me. Like, what is the signal here? Like, what is the sort of thing I can learn about the world from what you guys experienced?
There's a oftentimes when I look at decks, my mind inherently goes, how does this increase revenue for the organization or the buyer, as opposed to the other side of the coin being, how does it save expenses? I generally think if there is no CPT code you can build for this and in practice, not just in theory, and there is no revenue model for this, it's unlikely to succeed. Now, AI scripts have argued against this. Clearly, right? How do you think of when a startup is pitching to you, do they need to tell you this is a CPT code, this is how my customer will make money by using my product? Or is it more, I'm just going to grow and grow and grow, and I will get sticky enough that at some point people will pay for my solution as it becomes incorporated into their workflow and they cannot work without it. And it seems like open evidence, Hippocratic AI, AI scribes, it seemed like they're all like, we're just going to grow. And then people will eventually pay for it because it's almost like oxygen at some
Open
point.
Evidence has something clever going on. They have NPIs, they have search queries by what people submit, and they sell pharma ads. So they've essentially stolen Doximity's business model, but made it much more valuable. I see Doximity as a bogus company that we only use for a free fax. It's like our dirty secret as doctors. I've never met anyone who's ever used Doximity ever for anything, and all I do is hang out with health IT people
What
and
else
doctors.
does it do?
It has a news feed. I don't know. That's the amazing thing. I use it as a phone, like a phone app and a fax machine. And basically they have my NPI and they make all their revenue through ads. And Open Evidence has done the same. And that is just such a dope and good business model. If it remains free forever, they're like pilling, they're milling, GLP-1 ads to me, knowing my NPI, my geography, et cetera. That will make them boatloads of money forever. If that's all they do, like they've already made a ton. So that model I find really fascinating. For your question, I use the framework I mentioned, the enterprise sale framework. I think of for the economic buyer, different kinds of economic buyers care about different things. If it's a healthcare system, they almost always discount any promise of like I reduce costs, so you will make money in a statistical sense long term. Because it's like the well's been poisoned. So many companies have said that for so long and it's never true. So it's like they would believe that if you've been on market for 5 years and you have incredible validation, health economic outcomes, like they will buy that story. Revenue is a much easier story for them to tell. There are weird niches where people will pay for other things. Like if you're in a cash pay competitive specialty doing something that really benefits from like white glove concierge service, there is an intriguing willingness to pay where people are like, if it makes people do their knee surgery with me and not the person next door, that's interesting. Like, that is interesting to me. So, for folks like that, they may pay for different things. I use that as my wedge to be like, is this a credible story? Can it move customers?
What would your 20-year-old self think of the work you're doing right now and where you are right now, your career?
I think the most intriguing thing my 20-year-old self would clue into is the fact that I live my life not totally obsessed with status and with hype when I was 20. And I think one of the reasons I stuck with this politics thing as long as I did is I was so fixated in the rat race and prestige and hype, et cetera. After I had my big burnout and I was like, I just want to do stuff that I enjoy with people I like, I had the courage to say, I don't want to join a fund. I'd rather build a fund. I'd rather be like, I'd rather like go to a happy hour and everyone be like, I don't know this guy. I'm gonna go hit up like, this dude from like famous fund instead. Like, I'm totally happy being a background character. I'm totally happy just being a random like, guy doing his thing. I'm not so concerned about like, status, hype, rank. I just like being good at what I do, doing it with people I love, hanging out with folks I really care about. I think that would have been the thing that really sticks with 20-year-old me. And it would have been very strange and it would have been very frustrating because it's one of those things that's like insight versus knowledge. Like you can give knowledge, you can be like, yo, like, let me show you this math proof. And it's like, cool, like, cool, like, now I know it. And then there's insight, which you just have to learn. And I think that I'm kind of stupid. I just couldn't understand the stove is hot until I kept touching it and burning my hand. And finally, the inside hit me, and I'm like, ah, like, this is how it works. So that would be the thing that most surprises me. And it probably would have like perplexed me and maybe infuriated me because I would have been like, cool. But like, I don't know how I become that guy, because I still kind of really care about these things.
What are you excited about in healthcare in the next 5 years? And what are you excited about with your personal career life?
In my, so on the VC side, I think that there is an unstable, we had after like 30 to 40 years of extremely stable policy consensus, bipartisan on healthcare, it's become a total knife fight. Like the balance of power between payers, big providers, small providers, life science pharma is all kinds of messed up. How it maps to left and right, how it maps to parties, all messed up. Who wins and who loses, totally messed up. The Trump administration has basically burnt down everything that we understood about, balance of power in our sector, when they came in. And if you look at their policy considerations, it's all over the map. It's terrifying as a citizen. But the old system that's kind of burning down had a whole bunch of problems with it. And I'm very curious about, is there a window in all this chaos to back the right kinds of companies, the kinds of companies that I'd be proud to see exist in the world that can build and blossom, because a lot of stuff is cracking in our healthcare system. Is there something that we could do that's interesting and better? I find that stuff really intriguing. And we always talk about how there's like a new era of AI, but this recent era of AI is a whole bunch more interesting than CNN's were 10 years ago. So I'm also very intrigued by, what are the kinds of things, like maybe actually, like we're actually finally getting serious about stuff that can minimize paperwork burden, et cetera. Really not by improving the existence of paperwork, but really just making paperwork a tedious things that computers fight with each other about and sort of disintermediate us more and more. These are some things I'm excited about for in my investing hat. In my personal hat, one of the really big insights I had as a VC is that work expands to fill the time. You probably feel this. There's like an infinite number of happy hours and things you can do, et cetera. And sometime in the past 2 years, just running a team of four, I got so busy that I had to cut down a lot and I just did a lot less. And the amazing thing is I found out that I could both do a lot less and still be as or more effective and have actually like free time to think and do deep work. And the thing I'm most excited about in my personal life is, more deep work. Like in an entire year, me and you as VCs, there's like one or two documents that we signed and wires that we approved that were like by and far the single most important stuff we did that year. And if that was all we did that year in the story of our lives, like that would probably be enough. Like, everything else washes away. I like the idea of more time, spinning around in a chair or floating around in the ocean, thinking deep instead of just going, 5 days a week, 7 to 8 hours of 30-minute coffee chats back to back.
There's a lot of physicians listening to this podcast, and they're wanting to break into startup investing, venture capital, entrepreneurship. What piece of advice do you have for them?
I would toss out a few things. On the entrepreneurship side, I would say don't overthink it. Doctors have always been entrepreneurial. Almost everyone who you think of when you were a kid and they were doctors were doing something like very entrepreneurial. And almost certainly, because of the nature of our work, you have a fixed and totally safe employment thing that you can turn to if everything blows up. So feel that you have swagger. Random people just show up and start doing things, people with less tools than you. This is a great era because there's a million things that you don't know, and there's so many tools that can help you. There are people that can help you. And also with ChatGPT now, it's like, it's pretty good at, like, it may not know everything and it won't be an expert, but it certainly is a few chapters ahead of you in a bunch of, entrepreneurship topics you want to learn about. It'll point you in the way to, read and learn and grow. We've learned harder things. So I would say on the entrepreneurship side, go for it. On the healthcare side, I would say the most important thing for investing either time or money in a company is know axis of complexity and know where you're smart. And if the main complexity in something is, let's say you're a cardiologist, let's say you're an interventional cardiologist and you're looking at stents, and if the main axis of complexity for that company is like a technical innovation in, some kind of technical innovation that's legible to you as a proceduralist who does it, where you're like, if we do this, is kind of a big deal. Like, I would pay a lot more money. Cool. That is a good bet. If the axis of complexity is totally illegible to you, if you're an interventional cardiologist and you're looking at an orthopedic screw for hand surgery that angles slightly differently than the incumbent screw, then it's like, have humility and like be like, is this like, is this really like, the right kind of bet? The other is that you're too smart to have to know everything and be the extra expert. In the same way, we don't expect the interventional cardiologist also to be an expert in, advanced management of renal tubular acidosis or something. It's like, use the team in the same way. It's like, you're too smart to be like, learning everything and being the expert. It's like, if you see a deal and you love it and you're like, I love this med device, I love the technology, but like the whole cap table thing, some of these weird terms that they've like given to, that's kind of beyond me. It's cool. You're too smart to like, become an expert in that. Use the team, ask friends, ask your network, et cetera. It's how we work in the hospital. I think it's also what makes us successful when we invest. I think we're much more team player oriented. It's the same game, use the same skills.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Dimitra.
Cool. Appreciate you, Rashad. It's always fun to do this.